Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week on Viewpoints, we're going to talk a bit about amateur radio, which some of you may know as ham radio, and we're going to talk with Tim McGee about how he got involved in ham radio and the rewards he finds in this activity as a visually impaired person.
But first to our tip of the week. This week's tip is that ham radio is a great hobby for visually impaired people.
Do you think ham radio attracts blind people because it's something that's so audio-oriented?
I definitely do. And I think not only is it audio-oriented, but I think that it's a wonderful outlet for folks to meet people. I mean, I've met so many wonderful people over the last 50 years through this hobby.
When we talked to you last week, you mentioned that as a 12-year-old visually impaired child, you thought that the ham radio interest opened up a lot of social outlets for you. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, sure it did. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the gentleman who lives in Turkey, I'm actually closer with his family than I am my own. And I met him back in 1963, 64, and I've been friends with him and his family ever since. And that's just an example. I mean, I've met a lot of wonderful people. And it's that common bond. I mean, you could be talking to the president of General Motors. You could be talking to a dairy farmer. You could be talking to whoever. And it's that common interest. It's that common bond that puts everybody on the same plane. It puts everybody on the same level of interest.
And also, it's something you can do from the comfort of your own home and not have to worry about rides and transportation.
Absolutely. We call it the ham shack. I have my shack down in the basement. The basement is finished off here, and I've got my room, and I thoroughly enjoy the time that I am able to spend down there.
Before talking with Tim, Nancy and I knew very little about ham radio ourselves. But we're going to see how Tim got involved in ham radio himself as a young child and how easy it is for a visually impaired person to participate in this hobby these days.
Isn't it wonderful all of these friendships that Tim's been able to make, and not just you think you're friends for 5 minutes during a single interaction over the radio, but some of these friendships have lasted for decades and become, you know, real serious, personal, rewarding interactions. Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll meet Tim McGee.
Low CQ, calling CQ 40 meters. This is WB2KAO, Whiskey Bravo 2 Kilo Alpha Oscar, WB2KAO at Rochester, New York, calling CQ 40 meters and listening.
Now, if you're a ham radio hobbyist, you may know what all that means.
That's how he would typically introduce himself when initiating a general ham session. CQ is ham shorthand for saying, well, I'm out here. Does anybody want to talk to me? But here's another introduction from Tim for the rest of us.
Nice to meet all of you. My name is Tim McGee, and I'm a resident in the Greece area.
That refers to the town of Greece in Rochester, New York.
Yes, Greece is in the northwest quadrant of Monroe County. I have been an amateur radio operator since the age of 12, 1963. I am married. My wife is in the special education department at Brockport High School, and we have his and hers. I have two stepdaughters, 32 and 30, a 26-year-old son from my first marriage, and seven grandsons. I did attend the New York State School for the Blind in Batavia from kindergarten through eighth grade, from 1956 through 65. I went to Mount Carmel High School in Auburn and came back up here and went to St. John Fisher, earned a bachelor's degree in sociology, and worked at Delco, ITT Valeo, from 1973 until I retired in May of 04.
So now Tim has even more time to enjoy his ham radio activities with his friends around the world.
Tim mentioned that he went to a school for the blind. Batavia is maybe an hour or so from Rochester, and there were a large number of blind people from all of upstate New York who went to that school. As you may guess, he's blind.
I gather you've been blind since you were very young?
I was born premature. I was born at 6 months, weighed 2 pounds and 5 ounces. RLF situation, overdose of oxygen when I was in the incubator, unknown of medical science, not the fault of any particular doctor or hospital, but you never look back, and our glasses are always half full.
RLF stands for retrolental fibroplasia, and that's the condition that a large number of premature babies got if they were born in the 40s and 50s because they were given too much oxygen at birth, and the doctors didn't know that that was a problem, but these babies kept winding up blind.
That was pretty common back then.
Tim's actually grateful that he's alive. He said when he was born, he was small enough to fit in a shoebox and his head was the size of an orange. And these days, that's nothing for those babies to survive and thrive, but not when Tim was born. So he considers himself very lucky.
You are listening to Viewpoint.
This week's focus topic is about being a blind amateur radio operator, otherwise known as a ham radio operator. As Pete mentioned, neither one of us knew a whole lot about ham radio when we got started on this endeavor, and so we turned to Wikipedia, one of our favorite sources, and they say amateur radio, also called ham radio, is the use of a designated radio frequency spectrum for purposes of private recreation, non-commercial exchange of messages, wireless experimentation, self-training, and emergency communication. The term amateur is used to differentiate it from commercial broadcasting, public safety such as police and fire, or professional two-way radio services such as maritime, aviation, taxis, etc. So now that we know what ham radio means, let's start talking about it. And Tim got started learning about ham radio when he was a kid.
My parents found out about some amateur radio classes that were being taught at the Rochester Museum, I believe, at that time. And my dad brought me down there, and they were just finishing up the course for that semester. But the gentleman who was teaching the course offered to tutor me privately on Friday evenings. I would come home from Batavia on the weekend, take the bus home on Friday afternoon, and then my dad would often bring me back on Monday morning so that I could have the extra night at home. But this gentleman, Doc Thompson, very, very nice gentleman, offered to tutor me at his home out in Chilai. We lived in Brighton at the time, and my dad brought me out there, and he taught me the Morse code and the theory necessary to pass the novice test.
You know, having supportive and proactive parents can be so important, you know, because when you're young, you really don't have the experience to know what's good for you and what things you can possibly do. So you need a little bit of help, and you need someone to point you in the right direction.
We wondered what sparked Tim's interest in ham radio.
What was the initial impetus? Had someone in your family been a ham radio operator, or your folks just thought this would be interesting, or you were into electronics?
My dad had a good friend, Bob Sproul, W2QJT, Queen Jack 10, was his call sign. And my dad was very good friends with Bob. And I think they saw maybe how much fun and what nice friendships Bob had made through the hobby. And I think my parents felt that this is something that I could be independent at and that it would be a nice positive outlet for me.
And it really seems to have worked out well for Tim. The other thing I thought is interesting is how they all refer to each other by their call letters. In fact, you mentioned, Nancy, that many of the ham radio enthusiasts that we know have their license plate numbers be their call letters.
There are several levels of licenses for amateur radio operators.
We have three classes of amateur radio license now, and the Morse code is no longer required. We have the technician, the general, and the extra class.
What are the differences in what you need to know for those various classes?
In all three cases, there are rules and regulations regarding the frequency band segments that you're allocated to operate on, and the complexity of the theory exam becomes more difficult as you go from technician to general and to extra.
And as you get to the more advanced, this must enable you to be able to do different things as a radio operator?
Yes, it does. It does permit you to operate on all frequency segments of the amateur spectrum.
As Tim mentioned, hams used to have to know Morse code, but these days the communication is done primarily by voice, since the bandwidth is a whole lot better than it used to be 100 years ago. Here's what the alphabet sounds like in Morse code. Each letter consists of 1, 2, 3, or 4 tones, each being either long or short. Each number consists of 5 tones, and each punctuation mark consists of 5 or 6 tones. And apparently people get pretty good at not only understanding this alphabet, but also really fast at sending it. And some people are able to send it at, you know, 50, 60, 80 words a minute.
No, this isn't a national emergency and your radio hasn't broken. That was just Morse code. But anyway, yeah, I thought it'd be interesting to learn Morse code and might be kind of difficult. But I suppose if you can learn Braille, maybe it's not much different. And this you can listen to instead of feeling. Use your other senses.
Of course, Tim started out as a beginner, but over the years, he's grown to higher and higher skill levels at ham radio.
In 1963, I got my novice. Back then, you had to upgrade within a year to the technician or the general class license, or you lost everything and had to start over. So in 1964, I did pass my general exam, and I was a general for 30 years. And in 1994, I actually ordered the cassette tapes from the Handy Ham organization in Golden Valley, Minnesota, the ARRL license manuals for the advanced and for the extra class license were on tape, and I was able to listen to those. And I did go to a class for the advanced and passed that in May of 94. That is no longer a class of license.
So to get your license, as Tim points out, there are a number of tests or exams that you have to take in order to get the various degrees of licenses, but the manuals for learning what you need to know to pass the test are all accessible these days, so you shouldn't have any problem learning the information you need to learn.
Right, and the people who give out the licenses want people to succeed, so there's plenty of training available.
Right, they're not trying to keep people away from being ham radio operators. They just want to make sure people are competent, know what they're doing, don't run into other people, you know, take up spectrum space where they shouldn't, just learn the rules of the road, sort of.
So Tim, in case you can't tell, is very enthusiastic about ham radio, and he's very active in the local ham radio community and is particularly proud of one service that he's able to provide to the other local ham operators.
I actually own a repeater station, which is a relay station, which is over on the Warm Tower, where 101.3 is located. I've had an antenna on that tower at the 300-foot level of that tower since 1988.
Just for our other listeners, that's a local radio station, Warm 101.
That is correct.
I take it the purpose of these repeaters is to extend your range and the range of others?
Right, exactly. In other words, we could have somebody with a small handheld radio in Pittsford, for example, one of our southeast suburbs, and another person out in Hamlin. They'd be about 40 miles or so, 40, 50 miles apart, and they would be able to communicate through my repeater.
On just little handsets?
Yes, exactly. We have a very, very nice group on my repeater. We also have a link on my repeater called EchoLink, which is a link between the internet and the repeater. And I have a very, very good friend who lives in Turkey, and I have a chance to chat with him on Wednesday mornings at about 9:15. Every Wednesday we visit. It's the same as, a Skype or whatever. It's a voice over IP program strictly for amateur radio operators.
Got it. So first you get to the repeater over the airwaves, and then the repeater directly hooks into the internet. Is that the idea?
Yeah, we actually have a radio with the computer interfaced to it, and this is controlled with touch tones or with a DTMF.
Well, that's a great service that Tim is able to provide to other enthusiasts, and it's interesting to see how they leverage the technology to hook directly into the internet and extend the range of communications and the extent of the world over which they can communicate easily.
So there was an example of where improved technology has really made it a lot easier for all ham operators to do what they do better than they used to. In particular, 50 years ago, it was a real challenge for a person with a visual impairment to operate a ham radio.
A friend of mine built up a little audio tuning device. Of course, back then, the equipment that I owned had tubes in it. And the radios that we have now are all solid state and very, very easy to operate. But he actually built up a little audio device that was hooked in series with the meter on the transmitter, and I was able to tune up the transmitter and whatever.
And what was the feedback to know what your frequency was? They didn't have a voice output, did they? Or it's just a tone?
A lot of the receivers had what they call crystal calibrators, which gave you a marker tone every 25 kilohertz or every 100 kilohertz or whatever. The first receiver that I had, though, didn't have that, and I just had to listen and kind of be aware of how many turns of the dial there were between point A and point B, and it wasn't really that easy.
I'm always impressed how clever people were back when technology wasn't advanced enough to be able to make some of these things easy. People just figured out ways of using whatever available technologies or non-technologies they had to make things work. And just by being a little bit more patient, it may have taken a little bit more time, but being careful and using a combination of his listening skills and tactile skills, he was able to negotiate using a ham radio and communicate with folks around the world.
But things sure have gotten easier.
The equipment today has voice synthesis option boards that will tell you what frequency you're on. It'll talk about the various settings that the radio is in and various modes that it's in. Matter of fact, I just bought a brand new radio, a Kenwood TS-590S, and very, very easy for me to operate.
Is it standard practice that pretty much any modern ham radio you buy will have the speech synthesizer in it, or did you have to get a special unit?
Most radios today have that as an option, and it was a $70 option in this case. But, you know, when you've spent $1,500 on the radio, I don't mind spending another $70 for it to tell me all kinds of things that I need to know.
So are these add-ons made and sold by the manufacturer of the device itself, or you get it from some third party?
In the case of the three major Japanese manufacturers and the U.S. manufacturers, they are all designed and offered by those companies. Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Elcraft, Tentech, they're all available as options from those companies.
And do they do that specifically for the visually impaired, or is this something that even sighted ham radio users like to use?
I think that sighted ham radio operators probably do. People that have rigs in their vehicles, people that might not want to look at the display or be distracted for one reason or another, I would think that it would probably have its place.
I was really surprised to learn that a lot of these assistive devices were actually sold by the manufacturers of the ham radio equipment. So often we think of accessibility as sort of an add-on, and you have to go to someplace else, some third party, to make your equipment accessible. So that's really cool. People are thinking about it more these days.
Well, and the visually impaired community is benefiting from the fact that many of the other users want to be able to operate eyes-free. If you can imagine driving a huge tractor trailer on the interstate going lickety-split, you probably don't want to be looking at your dials and knobs going that fast.
Some of the technologies for the blind are actually useful for people who can see, aren't they?
Right. In the tip of the week, Tim spoke about how ham radio is a great way to socialize and make new friends. In fact,
I understand you have some interesting story about how you met your wife.
I did meet my wife on the ham radio. She was living in the Syracuse area. I had been laid off from Delco for a little bit back in the mid-70s. I was in Auburn, and we had a chance to meet back in 1976. And both of us went through first marriages, but then we had a chance to get together in 1990, and we were married on June 25th of 1991. She is a licensed amateur radio, but she's not active in the hobby anymore. But that's okay. She always keeps her license renewed, and she does call me once in a while on the repeater from the car or something if she needs me or wants me for something or whatever.
It's your own private cell phone.
Yeah, well, we have those too.
That makes it sound almost like the original Match.com.
For those of you who don't come from upstate New York, you just got a quick geography lesson to many of the suburbs of Rochester where we and Tim live, and some of the surrounding cities, Auburn, Syracuse, Batavia. Well, we know not all of you live in upstate New York. Ham radio operators are known for keeping track of the countries they've contacted. Well, so do we. And by late June, when we recorded this show, Viewpoints had been downloaded by people in all 50 states in the United States, as well as the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, 8 Canadian provinces, and over 70 other countries. And we are thrilled that people all over the world are listening to this show. And maybe you'll get in touch with each other if enough of you pick up ham radio, you can start talking to each other that way.
So that's pretty gratifying to us. Thanks for your listenership and keep passing the word.
Now for this week's high-tech item, how you can get involved in ham radio.
So for somebody who wants to get started as a ham operator, you just said you spent $1,500 on your latest radio and didn't mind putting in another $70 for the speech. I assume there are less expensive options for beginners?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely.
What would a low-end beginner system be like, and what would that cost?
If somebody wanted to get onto the local VHF and UHF repeaters, be able to chat with the local radio amateurs to get started, you can buy a little handheld radio now for, you know, like $100 or less. And a full-featured radio that runs off of 13.8 volts DC, either off of a power supply or in the vehicle, would cost about the same. About $100.
So it sounds like cost shouldn't really be an impediment for someone who wants to get into this hobby. How else would someone get involved in this? I mean, it sounds like there's some tests that you need to take. There's some licensing. How does one get started? Where would you turn to?
We have a wonderful radio club here in Rochester, the Rochester Amateur Radio Association. Their website is rochesterham.org. They offer license classes. The other organization that I made reference to that I got some tapes from is the Handy Ham organization in Golden Valley, Minnesota. That would be worth checking out. I'm sure that they have the latest ARRL license manuals in audio form for the technician, general, and extra class licenses.
And as usual, we'll have links to all those contacts in our show notes associated with this show.
The Handy Ham organization that Tim mentioned is for amateur radio for people with disabilities. So they are specifically geared to having information for people with visual and or other disabilities. And they're at handyham.org, handiham.org. He also mentioned the ARRL, that's ARRL.org. And that's the National United States Association for Amateur Radio People. And there's also an International Amateur Radio Union, and they're at IARU.org.
If you're interested in checking out ham radio, it doesn't cost a whole lot to get started. Like many hobbies, you can start inexpensively and probably spend as much as you want once you get really into it, but you can start inexpensively, meet some people around town. You may find that there are some ham radio organizations in your town, so it's a good way of networking, meet some people, talk to some people who are interested in it. And of course, the internet is a great resource for picking up more information and networking with other people, finding manuals, talking with people, and you're not alone.
So we called this segment the high-tech segment of the show, but you don't actually need to be a high-tech kind of person to get involved in ham radio.
You know, no matter what modus operandi you use to get her done, the government is not testing to see whether you are an electrical engineer. They're testing to see whether you have a basic knowledge of the material. I've always been interested in amateur radio from the sociological standpoint, from the communication standpoint, from the friendship standpoint. I am not the least bit technically oriented. You don't have to be technically oriented at all, really. That can come later if you want. You don't really have to understand the material necessarily. You can just memorize it and go and take the test. However, you can figure out how to get her done.
Hopefully your interest has been piqued a bit to learn a little bit more about ham radio and see if it might be interesting for you. And maybe you'll get involved, meet some people just like Tim did.
And here are some final words from Tim.
I think the message that I would want to leave with the listeners is this is a great hobby to get into, to meet people. And people are friendly and they're outgoing and they're helpful. And it's just a great give and take. That's great.
Well, that sounds terrific. If there's something that you can get a lot of pleasure with and meet other people and interact with other people, that can be very rewarding.
So let's say goodbye to our friendly ham radio operator.
All the best of 73, which means best regards. It's been very, very nice meeting all of you. Health and happiness. And this is WB2KAO, off and clear.
Over and out from Peter and Nancy.
If you missed any of the links we mentioned, they'll all be in the show notes, which you can find at our website, www.viewpointsplus.net.
That's it for show 1231. Next week, we'll be talking about how to subscribe to and listen to podcasts. While you're too busy to listen to your favorite radio shows or other audio programming when it actually airs,
we'll show you how to use podcasts to listen to them when it's convenient for you. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to contact@viewpointsplus.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpy and Peter Torpy in partnership with WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.viewpointsplus.net. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Viewpoints Plus. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day.